You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome back into another glorious, glorious episode of the Kansas City Baseball Vault. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Hurr. With me, the ever incomparable Michael Engel. Michael, how's it going?
Can you, I mean, once you're incomparable, are there degrees of being incomparable? Does that work that way?
I think so. You know, All right, sometimes cool. It's got to be like, well, you know, he's kind of incomparable when talking about, I don't know, right? I mean, there's got to be.
I guess
qualifiers.
I'll take it. I mean, I'm good. That's just long story short. I'm good.
All right, there we go. Of course, and of course, the as the Kansas City Baseball Vault, we are brought to you by Kelly's West Portland. And speaking of which, Michael Engel, this weekend, on I guess it's the day before Memorial Day.
Yep.
Technically, or at least before the day off we get. I can never remember if they have it on the Sunday before, if they consider that the holiday, or the Monday after. But Memorial Day, I believe, is the Monday after. So, but May 25th, so this Sunday, nobody should have to, the majority of people probably won't have to go to work because it is, in fact, Memorial Day, as we just discussed. Kelly's is having their block party. So starts at 8 o'clock. Get there. The sun will probably still be up. Should be great weather. Kind of do some little late in the day drinking, and then Lost Wax hits the stage at 9:30, and they will play all night long. And when I say all night, I mean all night, because Michael Engel, he does not lie, and he said it before. And so there you have it. Kelly's Westport Inn block party, May 25th, starts at 8. Lost Wax takes stage at 9:30. You should totally be there, because it's going to be a fun time. And before we get to the block party this weekend, we have some baseball things to discuss, because this is, believe it or not, a baseball podcast, despite what iTunes would like us to believe. Now, not only is it a baseball podcast, but we have Royal stuff to talk about, of course. So we're going to start with some good things here, kind of as part of our recap segment. First, let's start off with Danny Duffy. Now, I wasn't able to follow, I wasn't able to watch, I should say, most of the games this weekend. I was actually out of town at a friend's wedding, but we were at the wedding following along on Saturday, and kind of piece by piece hearing all these good things about Danny Duffy and having his easily best outing as a pro. And I mean, depending on how his career goes, who knows, it could be the best one ever. Hopefully it's only the start of many better things to come. But he took, I believe he took a perfect game into the seventh inning. Is that right?
Yeah, he got through 6.2 innings of perfect baseball, and then Adam Jones broke it up with a hit up the middle.
And he ended up finishing the seventh inning, right?
Yeah, he did. It was the first time in his career he'd pitched into the eighth inning. So, I mean, that was a very good thing. He was really efficient all night, and really, I mean, I guess if you shut down 20 straight batters, you're going to have a pretty good pitch count. And that's kind of been the thing with Duffy all the time, is how well can he manage his pitch count? And, you know, on this day he was really, really good with it, and he didn't strike out more than two batters, which is kind of strange. He did get some help from his defense, an excellent play by Alex Gordon.
Yes, now that I did see, I saw that in a highlight later. That was, I mean.
And that was, you know, in the sixth inning. That was Markakis leading off in the seventh, actually. And that's the play where you start to think, you know, once you hit the sixth inning and you're in that no-hitter perfect game territory, that's where you really have to kind of pay attention. Mm-hmm. And when Gordon made that play, I think pretty much anybody watching was like, okay,
it's fate. It's meant to be.
This could be a thing, because there seems to be that play in every big game, no hitter, perfect game, what have you. There's one excellent play that probably should have been a hit but wasn't. In the end, you know, he didn't get it, but it was still really darn impressive to see him go out there. And really, it was something the Royals had to have, because they'd lost the previous two games and they only scored one run on Saturday. anyway. So, you know, in like first inning, they score a run, and that run held up through the whole game. And Danny Duffy was the big part of it because he pitched a great game.
And I mean, that that's just phenomenal news for the Royals because, and, you know, we couldn't be happier for him, obviously. I think everybody, not just talking about us on the show here, but everybody in Kansas City, I think, wants him to succeed because, for the most part, I think he's really endeared himself to the fans. You know, he's a very, very passionate guy that you can absolutely tell the passion he has for the game and for the Royals. And that's just, you know, we've talked about how he's kind of that more or less wild card. You know, it's they weren't necessarily depending on him because he started the season in AAA and then came up and was part of the bullpen. But they were kind of hoping he would take that next step. And if you're ever hoping for a pitcher who's kind of struggled with command to take, you know, that next step and be assert himself as a starting pitcher, then that outing is literally exactly what you would ask for. I mean, if you really wanted to get nitpicky, you might ask for a couple other strikeouts, you know, maybe five or something. I don't know. But
yeah, you could.
I mean, that's just being incredibly, incredibly picky. I mean, couldn't have asked for a better outing from Duffy, and you hope it's a little inkling of things to come. And maybe, you know, it was he's trying to career, and he kind of lives around the edges, tries to nibble a little bit sometimes. That's what gets him in trouble. And the next thing you know, he's got 90 pitches in the fourth inning. So that's a problem. But maybe it takes an outing like this where he can realize, you know what, I don't have to strike everybody out, and I can still get through six innings of perfect baseball. You know, I can still get people out without striking them out. And then just as he uses that to gain some confidence and to realize he doesn't have to be absolutely perfect painting the black, then maybe all of a sudden it turns into his overpowering stuff, which he does have, this great stuff, all of a sudden turns into strikeouts organically. I think that's kind of the evolution of a lot of really good pitchers has kind of happened that way, where they, you know, maybe their command seemed a little, like when you look at the numbers, command might seem a little off, but, you know, in the end, they kind of learn, more or less learn how to pitch, you know, for lack of a better phrase, but to know that you don't have to be absolutely perfect to strike people out in terms of like painting the black or something. I mean, people like Randy Johnson and Nolan, mm-hmm. they had issues earlier in their careers with, you know, being a little wild, if you will, but it probably wasn't more or less. I mean, there was some command issues, I suppose, but I think a lot of it was also just them learning that they don't have to be absolutely perfect and just tick that edge. You know, they can move things around and actually be successful that way. I mean, does that seem like, I mean, you agree with that statement there?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Johnson's a really good example of that because he was this guy, you know, huge guy, 6'10", and could throw, you know, the wicked slider and big fastball and everything, but early on didn't really know where it was going, but, you know, he did figure it out. And Duffy's, you know, obviously he's not, I'm not saying he's going to be Randy Johnson, but, you know, he does have some of that kind of thing. Once he's hit the big leagues, he does have that issue of, you know, really having some command issues and control problems. And I think some of it is because, you know, coming up through the minors, he was able to blow guys away, and he didn't always have to, you know, hit spots because he had such good stuff. I mean, pretty good curveball, his changeup's okay when the curveball's not on, and guy can throw in the mid-90s as a starter. So, you know, you can rely on that and get by in the minors, but once you hit the big leagues, you know, every starter's got a fastball, curve, changeup, and a lot of guys throw mid-90s too. So you have to have something extra. And, you know, he really trusted his defense, and he said after the game that was a big kind of part of it. And I guess if you're going to be a pitch-to-contact guy, this Royals defense is the kind of defense to be that type of pitcher with. So, you know, that's shows something. I mean, I'm not a guy who really likes pitched contact because I think, you know, you can put the ball in play and it can find a hole. You know, if it's in the catcher's glove,
yeah,
you're not going to get a hit. Mm-hmm. So, but
yep.
I mean, if he's going to go with that approach a little bit more, it's probably going to pay off in, you know, more efficient pitch counts and deeper inning counts, and, you know, ultimately it's going to be better on the bullpen, it's going to be better on him. So
yeah, and we've kind of talked about this, especially with Scobie when we've had him on the show and then on various conversations on Twitter, you know, pitch to contact is a slightly misleading state, and you just hope that the Royals are communicating it correctly to Duffy, but it's more or less pitched to the contact zone so that you're not trying to, you know, like I was talking about earlier, paint the edges and you know, get some of those balls right on the black that, you know, an umpire, some umpires might call a strike, some might call a ball, where you get that variation, you know. So I think that's, you know, you want to hope that it's not saying, you don't want to go and take your pitcher out there saying, put the ball in play.
Right.
Necessarily, or at least I don't, because I'm with you, and the catcher's glove is much better than somewhere in the field, because who knows what can happen. Even if it doesn't find a hole, there could still be an error. Who knows? So, that's, I think, you know, hopefully if you're the Royals and you're saying you're talking about pitch to contact, you know, that's something that you're appropriately communicating that. But to talk about the Randy Johnson thing, and here are his walk numbers per nine innings for his first 4 years in the major leagues, right? 5.38, 4.92, 6.79. and 6.16, right? Those are his first 4 years. And then he had 3.49 and then 3.77 in 1994. And then he never had a walk rate that high again. And for the last 10 years of his career or so, for the last 10 years of his career, he had a walk rate below 3. You know, so I mean, there's an example. Danny Duffy is in no way Randy Johnson.
No.
You know, Randy Johnson's Hall of Fame player, one of the best pitchers of all time. So there's, you know, we're not trying to suggest that or anything, but just.
It is a pattern that, of development, yes, that pitchers can go through where they start, you know, in one kind of spot command and control wise, and it can settle down. They can settle into, you know, really understanding that, you know, they can hit their spots in the zone and aren't necessarily, you know, I don't want a guy to go up there saying, I'm not going to, you know, I don't want this guy to strike out. But, you know, if they're able to get outs and, you know, get their pitch counts going through pretty quickly, that's okay. But if they have strikeout ability, I want them to strike them out. I mean, I want them to gun them down. But, you know, I mean, there's no one way to do it, and I don't think you can try to strike everybody out, because it's never going to happen that you'll strike everyone out. But, you know, and especially with this team, if you do have the defense, you know, you'll take an early count out if you can get it. I mean, there's nothing
wrong with that. Absolutely. I mean, any out is a good out, but it's just a matter of, you know, limiting the possibility for any damage. But going back to one of the players who saved what at the time was still a perfect game, Alex Gordon, he kind of woke up a little bit this weekend, had himself a monster game on Sunday, the day after Duffy pitches great, and then all of a sudden the Royals bats explode, and Alex Gordon 2-3 goes 4-for-4 from the plate and hits two separate three-run home runs for 6 RBIs. I mean, just, we watched the game for a little bit, and we were down in New Orleans for this wedding, and we watched the game for a little bit. I wanted a bar down there and saw the first three-run home run, and then I checked my phone later, and up there, wouldn't you know it, there's a second one. And Butler went 3-for-4 that day as well. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of woken up a little bit, had a better week, had a pretty good weekend at the plate. Gordon had a really good weekend. I mean, they had another good offensive night last night, being Monday. We're recording, by the way, this is May 20th. So, May 19th on Monday, they had a better, they scored some runs. Unfortunately, Jason Vargas was the, at least for one game, was the Jason Vargas that we all feared.
Yeah.
He could be, gave up 3 home runs, lots of runs. It was kind of a back and forth game. The Royals didn't end up pulling it out, but they still had a little bit more offense. So, I mean, what do you see, Mike, that's encouraging about this? And do you think this is something that, is it finally, I mean, we make fun of the Royals, Royals talking heads for, oh, it's warm and the excuse train and all that kind of stuff. Or, I mean, oh, it's cold and you're getting that excuse train rolling. I mean, is this could they possibly have something now that it's warming up? You think the Royals' bats are actually going to warm up in the metaphorical sense, or was this possibly just another blip?
I think considering that it was Gordon and Butler kind of having these big games, that really lends itself to being a little more real. And Butler has talked, you know, over the last week, he's been hitting pretty well. And he's talked about some mechanical things that he's found that he's corrected. And you look at him at the plate, he looks a lot better than he has earlier in the year. He's hitting the ball with authority. I mean, he drove, you know, on Sunday, he drove that ball deep to the wall, you know, one or two more feet, and it's out of there. So he's been hitting pretty well. And Gordon even has been kind of quietly coming back. He had a little bit of a slump in there, but he's had a few games where he's gone 3-for-4, 3-for-5, 2-for-4, some offers in between, but it's worked out to where he's been able to kind of be about how, you know, you look at his April and his May, he had a lot more doubles in April, and so his numbers look a lot better. But his average and on base are pretty much the same in the month of May so far. And then you have a game like Sunday where, you know, 4-for-4 and those two homers, neither of which were in question when he hit them. It really, you know, it does kind of look like something that's going to be at least sustainable as a hot streak, if not all year. And anytime you get, you know, your 3-4, your 4-5, whatever they're hitting that particular day, your 3-4 guys to produce like that, I mean, you see what happens. They score, you know, 6 runs yesterday. They scored 8 runs on Sunday. If this team can score over 4 runs a game, they're going to be a handful for a lot of teams because their pitching and defense is so good. The problem is that, you know, Hosmer only has one homer, Butler only has one homer, and they really struggled to get runs around from those 3, 4, 5 guys in the middle of the lineup. And if they're waking up now, then that's a good thing, especially if you get Escobar still seems to be doing pretty well. Aoki's, I mean, mixed returns on there. He's perfectly average as a leadoff guy. I mean, he's been on base the second most times on the team. And I think he gets kind of unfairly painted into being this really bad player. Now, that, you know, doesn't take away, you know, and we're not trying to talk about Aoki right now because we want to talk about Gordon. But, you know, he's you know, not as advertised on defense, and he's not a good base runner, but I think he's been okay as a leadoff guy. But anyway, if you've got Gordon and Butler hitting, this team's going to be okay more days than not. If they're not, I mean, you see, you know, some of the scoring problems they've had recently. So, you know, I hope it sustains. They both look better. And, you know, their performance, you know, on paper is better, too. So, you know, those are going hand in hand. I think that's a good thing for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, as bad a start as Gordon got off to, I mean, he's right now he's hitting. This is kind of interesting. Just pulled up his stats really quick as you were talking. And last year his line was he hit .265 with a .327 on base and a .422 slugging. And right now he's hitting also .265 with a .324 on base and a .398 slugging. So, I mean, he's nearly equaling what he did last year, which was a decent year, not as good as the two before. So point being, you know, it looks like he's getting even better, and he's already to this point still doing what he did last year. So hopefully he kicks it up a little and gets more into that 2011-2012.
Yeah, and he's feasibly category. Probably not concussed this year, too. So.
Yes, and something also to note, his career BABIP, batting average on balls in play, is .320, and right now it's .293. So, I mean,
so there's room to grow.
There's room to grow for that. And, you know, in 2011, his best year as a pro, he hit .358. So, you know, we've kind of talked about batting average on balls in play on this show, but something to note is that there are hitters who, you know, typically you see 300 as that kind of mark where more or less everything regresses towards that mean. But at the same time, there are hitters who can consistently overcome that and have mm-hmm. a high BABIP. You know, like someone like Joe Mauer is like a .346 or something. That's just something ridiculous.
And
Ichiro, I mean, those players can
Austin Jackson is a guy, but that's mostly because he strikes out so much. So yeah. When you're looking at balls in play, it's a smaller sample of at bats to calculate it. But I don't think, you know, I think in, with guys like Butler and Gordon, it's because they do hit line drives. And line drives are, you know, 70% of the time, those will go for a hit statistically. Yep. So that's a lot better than the, like, 25% that a ground ball or fly ball will.
And so with that, we'll kind of move into the not as positive news. And something I wanted to bring up that I actually heard on the radio on the way home that, Mike, we haven't really discussed this yet. I forgot to bring it up before the show. But have you heard about this Hosmer Dyson thing? Have you heard about this? This is an off-the-field issue.
I saw briefly on Twitter.
I think it came out today, and that's why I ask.
Yeah. I mean, it was like literally probably when you heard it was the first time anybody else really heard it.
So we'll just kind of recap just because this – If 810 has their way, because I listened to Keatsman for a little bit on the way home, and again, this is May 20th, so when we're recording it. So if 810 has their way, I think this might they might try and blow this up a little bit. But so just to kind of recap, apparently there was the Manny Pacquiao fight, I believe, or was it Mayweather?
I think it was Mayweather.
Mayweather fight. I don't know. But this is not a boxing podcast. The Mayweather fight a couple weeks ago, apparently Eric Hosmer and Gerard Dyson decide, hey, we're going to go up to the 810 zone at Harrah's. We're going to watch this fight. So 810 zone at Harrah's has some sort of event for the fight, something that you have to buy tickets to. And part of the event itself ended up getting sold out. So there's no more tickets left. They're filled to capacity, to the point where you're talking fire code issue, that type of a thing, right? Which, you know, depending on the business, depending on the building, depending on the company, whatever, some take this very seriously, which as right they should, because you can get fined for it, you know, and in worst case scenario, it could end up, I mean, there's a reason those fire codes are in place. But that being said, Eric Hosmer and Gerard Dyson show up, and they're there past the time that it started because they came after a game here in Kansas City, and it was sold out. There's absolutely no room, fire code issue. Eric Hosmer and Gerard Dyson are turned away by the manager of this restaurant. Okay, this is the 810 zone. And so as a result, Eric Hosmer and Gerard Dyson apparently look at, and you know, rightfully so, that you know 810 zone is where they got turned away. So they decide they're going to boycott 810 radio. And so they, Danny Clayscale was trying to ask, I think it was Eric Hosmer and or Gerard Dyson questions today, and just completely got ignored or something. And just no responses. And they were more or less, they found out, you know, through kind of asking, I think they maybe talked to Swanson about it, and maybe a couple other people. They find out that they're being boycotted because of that event. Whereas even though this is according to, I mean, I heard this on the radio. So this is what I'm hearing is the 810 version of this,
right?
Which is never skewed, right?
Which is a Billy Butler sized grain of salt.
Yes. Well said, my friend.
Yeah.
But, so according to 810, and this is like more precisely, according to Kevin Keatsman, they reached out, Todd Lebo reached out to Eric Hosmer and his people more or less and talked to Eric Hosmer directly and said, hey, listen, you know, this 810 zone, 810 radio, it's a partnership thing, but we do not manage that restaurant. We do not make the decisions there. So we were not the ones that turned you away. You know, just to make that clear, the manager of 810 zone is completely separated, not an employee of 810, blah, blah, blah. Which I 100% believe. I have no reason to believe that's false. Mm-hmm. As far as everything I know about how they run everything is that that's true. So that is completely reasonable. And then their impression was that it was squashed. It was no big deal. And then talked to Danny Clingscale since then. And I believe it was in an interview capacity. But now all of a sudden today, there's this issue again. So then... And I guess 810 Keatsman said they had meetings about it and they had internal stuff and they talked about it and they didn't bring it up on air before this. They didn't say anything. And then now all of a sudden they're being shut out for interviews. So then gloves are off. And Keatsman was just railing on them, calling them privileged brats, babies, you know, Just the whole deal. And then they kind of snowballed that into this organization has a big problem with coddling young players that are their, quote unquote, sacred cows, which we've actually talked about on Twitter. Huh. You know, you've got people like Mike Moustakas out there who dude's never been accountable for anything in this organization. You know, same deal with Eric Hosmer, because what you're saying about Moose now and last year, you know, to a lesser degree, but still very relevant, could have been said about Eric Hosmer in 2012 in terms of play on the field. You know, he should have been sent down. I contended that all year. You know, he bounced back last year and everything's great. But, you know, in 2012, we talked about it a lot that on this show, he should have been sent down. And he wasn't. Mike Moustakas wasn't sent down last year. He wasn't sent down this year, or hasn't been sent down this year so far. And it seems there's a lack of accountability in there. I mean, we've talked about this ad nauseum on this show. So it's interesting to see them bring it up on the radio like that and have that little piece of inside knowledge. I mean, what, just hearing that story, I mean, what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I mean, I have a hard time kind of getting wrapped up in some of those things just because, you know, I mean, okay. I mean, I understand if they feel slighted a little bit. I don't know if that's their best reaction. And it comes on the heels of the Mike Moustakas thing where, you know, the Royals, someone, I don't know who talked to Andy McCullough, but they floated the idea of Mike Moustakas being sent down. And then like 2 days later, Dayton Moore got really defensive about that when people were asking about it, when they didn't send him down, when one of their own guys had done this. And then it turns around that Moustakas hits a, hits the big double against the Rockies on, I think it was Wednesday. And after the game, they're not talking, you know, he's not talking to anybody about his hit. He's talking about Jason Vargas's start. And, you know, the media got all in a huff about that too, because, you know, he's not talking to them about what they want to talk about. And, you know, probably not the best reaction for Moustakas either in that spot, but I think the media kind of blew it up a little bit too much too. I don't know. I mean, the Royals have always kind of had a weird relationship with the media that they feel like, you know, that article came out recently about how other media outlets nationally and in other markets and other executives feel more appreciative about what the Royals have done since Dayton Moore has been around and in the last 2 years, and that Kansas City doesn't seem to appreciate it the same way. And I don't know. They seem like a really self-conscious organization, and their dealings with the media haven't been great at pretty much any stage. I mean, you know, a lot of contradictions, a lot of just strange, you know, quotes, a lot of, I don't know. I mean,
well, and Keatsman brought up a good point that, how many times will I say that on the show? But that other players that weren't, you know, brought up by this system, weren't part of the quote unquote process, you know, your Mike Moustakas and Eric Hosmers of the world, but your James Shields and your Omar Infantes and those type of guys that have come from other organizations, you know, you don't see this kind of business from them.
Yeah.
And you don't see the childish Moustakas actions. You don't see any media boycotts or anything like that. And a lot of the reason is because, you know, Kansas City, at least I would, this was my thought when hearing it, but a lot of the reason I would imagine is because Kansas City is like the 28th biggest market. So, you know, how many people that come from other places are coming? You know, Omar Infante came from Detroit, and I'm not, Tampa Bay, that's a little bit different because I'm not exactly sure how their market relates to Kansas City. I think it's pretty close actually, but you know, in Detroit and, you know, especially some place like New York or LA or someplace like that, if Moustakas tried to pull the crap that he tried to pull, or Hosmer or Dyson pull this stuff, I mean, they'd just be roasted, you know?
Yeah.
Please imagine Mike Moustakas as a New York Yankee. First of all,
doing that, he'd have 50 more reporters badgering him about the same question.
He would have been lead story on SportsCenter. There'd be a freaking YouTube remix about it with
New York,
you know,
Post
him.
Would have something going on, like
some clever play on the word moose or Moustakas or something. I mean, and that's so. And it seems like, you know, more or less some of these guys, their goal might be to be out of Kansas City once their initial rookie contract is done. And if that's the case, I mean, this stuff's not going to fly. So it's interesting to me, and I think it becomes even more interesting when you bring it to that next level and snowball that into the argument of, is this an organizational issue? And I think, you know, we've kind of indirectly talked about how it is more or less on this show. And it's just, it's really interesting to me. I mean, I don't think we need to get too in-depth into it today, but I did think that was interesting and worth mentioning. But to move on to the on-the-field related stuff that's still not as positive,
right.
Sal Perez has hurt his hand. And have they said exactly how long he was going to be out?
Sounds like it's like 2 or 3 days. In response, I mean, they pulled him last night late. He wasn't swinging very well. And apparently it's been bothering him for a couple of days. And so today they ended up calling up Francisco Peña. So they have 3 catchers on the roster right now. With Brett Hayes started tonight. And Peña is acting as the backup, basically. So they're pretty much you set to on the idea that he is just not going to play. Like, emergency situation, he won't be in there. So it's those 2 catchers, and they'll just deal with it from an infield perspective as they need to and go with it. So, but he didn't go on the DL, so that's something positive, I suppose. I guess that's still an option, but it hasn't sounded like it's going to be a DL thing. It just seems like there's, you know, a bruise or banged it up. I don't know exactly what he did to it, but some soreness and inflammation and kind of go from there. And, you know, when you look at a guy like Perez, who's caught, you know, most of the games this year, I think he's had 4 games off, you know, you can understand how he's going to get banged up. So I guess he gets a couple days off, but it does kind of weaken their defense. It weakens their lineup. Unless Peña plays most of the next couple of days and, you know, ends up hitting well, which, you know, he's had some good power in Omaha, so that's a good thing.
And yeah, it's I mean, you've got this, and then a couple of days ago there was a bit of a scare with Perez. He had a run-in on the base paths where he kind of wrenched his neck a little bit with Manny Machado when they were playing the Baltimore Orioles, and he ended up being okay. He didn't even come out of the game, anything like that, but, you know, it was a scary sight. And this team needs Salvador Perez so much, because there's, you know, you want to talk about problems at third base in terms of depth and options. I mean, it's even worse at catcher. So if you don't have Salvador Perez, then this team is in some trouble. But I mean, it's kind of become a commonplace thing here, a yearly thing. There's some, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a huge issue, but at least once a year now for the last 3 years or so, he's had something that's kind of gotten in the way, and he plays so often and with so much intensity, so much passion, these things are kind of bound to happen. So, you know, you gotta wonder, the Royals just keep riding him like he's some sort of championship thoroughbred or something. I mean, they need to really kind of pull in the reins a little bit and give him more days off and give him more rest. I mean, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, you want him in there as much as you can, but I mean, you saw when early in the year when he had that really bad slump where he was like 0 for 21, 0 for 22. I mean, that was, you know, he'd basically played 3 weeks in a row during that stretch. So it was just a matter, you know, I can't imagine that he had all the energy in the world, you know, and he's going to put most of his focus on working behind the plate. And so if he's, you know, worn down after a couple of weeks and most of his energy is going to go behind the plate, yeah, his hitting is going to have a problem. And so it does seem like he needs more time off. It does seem like Yost really wants to ride him. And, you know, I think they seem like they want to play him 150 games, which is pretty much unheard of anymore for catchers, especially guys like Perez, who are, you know, franchise catchers. He's already had 1 knee surgery. He's already had a concussion, if not more than 1. And so, I mean, you got to be able to protect him. I'm interested to see kind of what happens after he's able to come back and who they stick with, because Brett Hayes still hasn't even reached base. He scored a run, but he's never reached base. The only time he scored a run was because he pinch ran for Perez.
Wow.
And ended up scoring. So, but he hasn't walked, hasn't been hit by pitch, hasn't gotten a base hit. And with Pena up, you know, once Perez is ready to come back and you know, kind of get back as the starter, you know, and he's all better with his hand, I can't imagine Brett Hayes sticking around. I think Pena is probably the guy they'll stick with unless he just looks absolutely dreadful at the plate. But I think it was time to make that change a while ago just because Hayes really – I mean, Hayes isn't – I mean, he's that guy. He's that backup catcher who's going to bounce around a lot and, you know, isn't going to do much of anything. He's going to give your guy a day off, and that's about it. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But he's, you know, not someone that you want to put in there if Perez was hurt long term. So I think Pena is probably the guy that they would look for. And now's a good opportunity to see what he can do, at least. And he's probably a better backup than Hayes. So I would expect him to and Omar Infante's due to come back off the DL, or at least he's eligible to come off the DL on Thursday. So if that coincides with Perez being available again, I mean, you do the math. It's a pretty easy equation from that point. They have three catchers. One of them doesn't have a hit. And they need a roster spot. Well, I mean, I wouldn't be too comfortable if I was Brett Hayes unless he wants to hit about four home runs over the next 2 days.
Which I would be fine with.
Oh, I'd be totally fine. Fortunately, they're in Kauffman. You can't hit homers at Kauffman unless
no, there's the impenetrable force field. It's like trying to hit on Stephen King's Under the Dome here, and the dome starts at the Kauffman Stadium walls. So that was a superbly nerdy response to that question.
That really was.
And with that, I think we'll leave and take our first break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about some stuff that we might have a couple more items to get to, or we might just jump into something that kind of we've already talked about but has caught a little bit more steam and could end up radically changing the game of baseball for the better. So stick with us and we'll see you on the other side of this break.
Kelly's Westport Inn has been a Kansas City tradition for generations, but now you can be part of a new tradition brought to you by Kelly's and the friendly neighbors at McCoy's. On Sunday, May 25th, come on out to the third annual Kelly's and McCoy's Block Party. Bring a friend, meet new friends. You can dance by yourself. We don't care. It's whatever makes you happy. There's just a $5 cover charge to get into the best outdoor party in Westport. And the fun starts at 8 p.m. Come out and enjoy the warm spring air and the best entertainment district the city has to offer. And while you're sipping on a refreshing beverage, in moderation, of course, enjoy the sounds of Lost Wax, who take the stage at 9:30 and will be playing long into the night. I mean, you're off on Memorial Day already, right? It's everything you could want. Great weather, great atmosphere, and the great people of Kansas City. And even better, you've got Lost Wax playing all your favorite tunes. That's on May 25th, starting at 8 p.m., the third annual Kelly's and McCoy's Block Party.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport. And one more reminder for you, we have May 25th, this very weekend, the day before Memorial Day, is the one and only Kelly's Block Party. Every year they have it, and it's a great time. You should go on down to Westport, grab yourself some drinks, have fun at the Block Party. Lost Wax hits stage at 9:30. You've heard them on this show before in some of the commercials. Great band. Get down there. Have some time. Show some support. Show some love to Kelly's, who's been an unbelievably awesome sponsor for us. And really, we wouldn't be here today if it weren't for Kelly's. So please go down. Have a couple drinks. Enjoy the three-day weekend. Have fun at the Kelly's Block Party.
And call a cab if you need to.
Absolutely,
you know,
yes.
You know, we want you to listen next week, too.
We preach block partying responsibly here on this show. So please, yes, as always, even beyond the Kelly's Block Party, if you drink, please be responsible. And as we said before the break, we've got a couple more items to hit on, specifically Royals-related here that we're going to talk to first. Everybody's favorite Billy Butler replacement, Justin Maxwell, was DFA'd. Mike, this doesn't get me too excited either way. What are your thoughts on this?
No, I mean, it looked pretty... it came up as an option, and I don't know that I really expected it, but I'm not surprised by it either. He just didn't hit. I mean, you know, he was pretty good last year after the Royals acquired him, but this is a guy who's 30, and he's never had sustained success at the big league level. I mean, in bit parts, he's been okay, largely because of his power, but he's not a contact guy, and he struck out 15 times in 29 at-bats this year with the Royals. You know, only had four hits. One of those was a double. He wasn't walking. And so basically, you know, you're looking at a guy with a 391 OPS. He wasn't going to supplant Alex Gordon in left. He wasn't going to take over for Lorenzo Cain in center. You know, Dyson has played well enough to take the time away from him. And Aoki's going to be a full-time guy. So there wasn't a real spot in the outfield. And the Royals wanted to get another bullpen arm, so they had to do something. And, of course, they weren't going to option Mike Moustakas, because why on earth would they do that?
No.
So it came down to Maxwell. So he's kind of in DFA limbo right now. They can still trade him. They could try to sneak him into Omaha. I mean, that's a possibility. I think he can refuse that assignment. I think he's been outrighted to a minor league assignment in the past. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think he has. He's been in the league long enough. He probably has.
Yeah, I'm sure somewhere he has.
So, I mean, and he's passed through. He's been on the Yankees, the Nationals, the Astros, the Royals. So, I mean, he's been through a lot of teams. They could trade him. I mean, they have a couple of days still where they could trade him if they were able to get something for him. I mean, he hit well last year. He, of course, had the grand slam, but he had a couple of other big home runs
with
Royal. So, I mean, you know,
he was a valuable piece kind of down the stretch. He had some big plays for this team. So,
yeah, he did. And I, you know, no ill will towards him. But I think the, you know, I wrote this thing. The first thing I wrote for Pine Tar Press was kind of talking about blind spots and how, you know, moments can really kind of take over common sense sometimes. And Maxwell was kind of a guy that I referred to because I think a lot of people will remember that grand slam, as they should, because it was an awesome moment, but he didn't really, you know, that's not who he's going to be. He's not going to be a guy who hits that grand slam in walk-off fashion all the time, and I think that's what people thought he would be able to do every time up, and he obviously wasn't, so.
That will quite literally probably be his only hit of that nature in his career, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not something that people should expect. You know, if it was Miguel Cabrera out there, then you'd be like, absolutely, you know, this is a threat every time, but not in this case. So, I mean, that was kind of interesting, but don't know that that is going to have a huge impact on this team going forward. Something that could have a bit of an impact, though, is a little something. Let me preface this by saying this is complete and utter Kansas City baseball vault speculation. We have no inside sources on this, nor do we have anyone even hinting at it. It's just an interesting thought that Michael Engvall came up with. So
I wasn't the first.
Okay, well, sorry. It's out there, and Mike brought it up, thought it'd be worth a small discussion. The Red Sox have picked up Stephen Drew, and they've moved Xander Bogaerts to third base, which means that, well, Middlebrooks is currently more or less without a home, and we all know the problems that Mike Moustakas has had. And one of the reasons, and even just straight up, Ned Yost in an interview, you want to talk about, you know, alternatives, then, or it was a Dayton Moore, maybe. That,
I think it was Dayton Moore.
Dayton Moore, like, sorry.
What's the alternative?
Yeah, what's the alternative to Mike Moustakas? So, well, you know, here's an alternative, more or less. I mean, Mike, what are your thoughts on Will Middlebrooks? Is he a good spot for the Royals? He may be a change of scenery guy. I mean, they're literally 2 days apart in terms of age. So,
yeah. You
know, you want to talk prospect status. I mean, I can't remember what Middlebrooks was ranked, but he was a pretty well thought of prospect. And he's played decent in his time so far. But I mean, right now his numbers are 190. He's hitting 197, which is awful, but
it's well still better than Moustakas.
Well better than Mike Moustakas, and his on-base percentage is 305. He's hitting 197, and his on-base is 305. Mike Moustakas' career on-base percentage is less than 305. Now, granted, so is Will Middlebrooks, but still, you know, that shows that he's at least contributing. You know, when he's hitting less than 200, he's still getting on base 30% of the time, which is much better than Mike Moustakas can say. So, Mike, I mean, what are your thoughts on this? And do you think this is a viable option that the Royals should consider?
I think they should consider it. I mean, I would advise them to at least call and see what the price might be on him right now. Because, I mean, change of scenery is exactly what it would be, because he really – if they're going to have Drew at short through the rest of this year and Bogaerts at third, I mean, there's not going to be a home for him. Right now, Middlebrooks is on the DL. He has a fractured right index finger, and I think he's probably still a ways out. So if anything's going to happen, it may not be soon. But this is a guy who, you know, his first 2 years in the league, he had 32 homers over 169 games. So he's got some good power. And granted, that was in Fenway for a lot of those, but I think you could see that as 25 home runs as a Royal, as long as he's, you know, able to make some contact. That's kind of the big issue with him too. You know, in 742 plate appearances, he struck out 191 times. So he's not, I mean, it's not enough to just say, okay, well, he's out there. He's been, I think he was in the 50s before 2012 in prospect rankings across the board. So you know, he's had that kind of top 100 status, that top 50 status as a prospect. So he's a guy that, you know, people thought highly of, but, you know, the more he's been in the league, the more he's struck out. And as a result, you know, it is something that does have to be considered, but he's also done better than Moustakas. And
yeah, as a point of reference, Mike Moustakas is hitting currently 153, 225, and 323.
And so it's to the point that Danny Valencia got a start against a right-hander today. And Danny Valencia doesn't hit righties well. And he also had an RBI double. So,
And Middlebrooks has, in 190 games and 742 plate appearances, Middlebrooks has 34 home runs, whereas Mike Moustakas has played 413 games, 1,631 plate appearances, and only has 7 more home runs at 41. So, I mean, now, granted, Mike Moustakas plays under the dome here in Kauffman. So that's totally – I'm totally using that, by the way, for this just ever on
the show.
Sounds
like a Photoshop opportunity.
Oh, man. I know just the person that can make that happen too. Oh, man, that's so happening. Sweet. Okay.
So stay
now,
tuned for that.
Back, yeah, stay tuned for that. Follow us on Twitter, and I'm going to post that eventually if I can get who I think can do it to make that. It shouldn't be very hard. Back to baseball. You know, I think it's an interesting option. And like you said, I definitely think the Royals should kick the tires. I mean, worst case scenario, you bring in, you know, a quality, someone who was a quality player. You know, granted, I think it would be a little bit more intriguing if he was a right-handed hitter. I was looking at Mike Moustakas' thing. Sorry.
Yeah,
he is a right-handed hitter. I apologize. I had Mike Moustakas' thing pulled up. So that does make him quite a bit more intriguing, because worst case scenario, you can turn these two into a platoon. And Middlebrooks, even though his stats are only okay, he's going to give you what Valencia gave you and probably better. And then maybe these two push each other, and they both turn out really well, and then you can flip one of them at the All-Star break. You know, so it's like we've preached before on this show, options are never a bad thing, and the more options the Royals have, the more opportunities they have to make this team better and to succeed. So if it's me, I'm definitely kicking the tires. I mean, what you think Mike Moustakas would go for on the open market right now, which is not much. You know, it would probably take a little more for someone like Will Middlebrooks, just simply because he's had better numbers over a shorter period of time for the most part. So, you know, I don't know what it would take to get him, but the Royals should find out, because I mean, you're not going to give up, nor are you going to have to give up a Rodon Ventura, Kyle Zimmer. You're not going to have to do that type of a prospect, because he just hasn't been that good. But, you know, maybe you give up. I don't know.
I'm not sure. It's tough to gauge, because he's got you know, the performance his rookie year where it was pretty good, a little lesser than that the next year. But, you know, I think he's also battled injuries, so that could be part of what's given him problems. I think he's going to strike out no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
But if a guy strikes out and gives you power and you're only looking at him as a, you know, number seven hitter, that's okay. I mean, his glove's not as good as Moustakas, so that's something to consider. And his cost might be higher than what Moose would go for because Middlebrooks has played less in the majors, so his arbitration is going to start a year later. Moustakas will be arbitration eligible next year. Middlebrooks would still have one more year of pre-arbitration. So, you know, that's going to be something, too, where, you know, his cost from a payroll standpoint will be less this year and next year. And so I think, you know, the Red Sox would be looking at that. But at the same time, teams are going to look at them and be like, look, we understand, we can tell you right now, this guy, we know you don't see this guy as a long-term option. I mean, maybe they do, but I doubt it. It really seems like a situation where he's kind of done. They have Drew for the rest of this year and Bogaerts at third, and I think they're comfortable going with that. And it's the Red Sox, so, I mean, they can just go sign a shortstop or a third baseman and just see what happens if they don't like Middlebrooks. So I don't know what it would take. I mean, maybe a Chris Dwyer type, maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure what they would want to do in this case.
And this can kind of even slightly tie into what we were talking about earlier. You know, if the Royals truly want to be a good organization that continues to win, these are the type of things that you need to look into. And these are the type of things that I'm not guaranteeing or saying anything about Will Middlebrooks, but just in general, you know, an opportunity like this where you have a player who's got some talent and has kind of struggled, you know, and maybe other teams look at Mike Moustakas this way. I don't know. But, you know, it's just something like Will Middlebrooks, it feels like a Billy Beane move, you know, or something where he shills some, you know, 28-year-old reliever from Double-A and turns him into Will Middlebrooks, who ends up going to Oakland and hitting, you know, 315 and hits 25 home runs or something like that, you know? I mean, that won't happen, but, you know, it just...
If the cost in a trade is small enough, I mean, there's almost no risk to it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because right now, I think whether they'll say it or not, I think the Royals have to be concerned about Moustakas. And, you know, things like now where, you know, Danny Valencia is essentially getting a tryout right now to they've already put him in a platoon. They've already, you know, Valencia started against a righty, which I never would have figured was going to happen. And, they've got to do something to get third base hitting. And if that means, you know, trying a speculative trade for Will Middlebrooks, then yeah, there you go. Go for it. You know, see what happens with it. And you know, if he doesn't pan out, if he still can't hit, if he still gets injured all the time, well, you're not really on the hook for a lot. I mean, if it turns out that way, you just don't tender him a contract when he's arbitration eligible and you move on. And you're in about the same spot you would have been. And by the time that comes around, Hunter Dozier might be ready or Chesler Cuthbert might be ready. And you know, the problem will solve itself by that point anyway. So it's definitely worth looking into. I mean, it's a guy with some talent. And, you know, even if they can't get it done, they should be calling to just find out, if nothing else.
Absolutely. And with that, we'll move into what we teased a little bit before the break, which was something that could, it's been out there. It's not new as of today, but today just came me about even more information about it. And it's something that could radically change the game. And it's this, these super advanced statistics that are even more so than your typical, you know, BABIPs and WAR and things like that. And we've talked about it before. I mean, is there like a name for this? Because every time I see it referred to, it's just kind of like
it's
super like, advanced stats, more or less. It's like they don't know what they're called.
I think it's tagged on MLB.com as like player tracking. Because in this case, that's basically what it's doing. It's you know, MLB Advanced Media came out with some new videos of some new applications of their player tracking video and whatnot. And this is the stuff where it'll show you like first step speed and transfer speed to get the ball out of your glove on a double play, and you know, pop times and velocity on throws from infielders and stuff like that. And it's just measuring a lot of things that is really pretty cool, the way they present it. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a game changer. We talked about this in, I think, March during spring training when a lot of it first came out. And the applications on defense, I mean, it just makes things so much more valuable. You can really get an idea. I mean, right now, you can kind of have an idea of how far Escobar goes in the hole to feel the grounder. You can't always tell, like, how far someone comes in. I mean, you can, but nobody really measures it. Like, how far someone might come in from second base to take the pivot on the double play, or, you know, counting how quickly the ball leaves the shortstop's glove when he's thrown it to second, and then, you know, what the second baseman does, getting the turn and getting it to first. And, you know, it's calculating player leads off the base and reaction times. And it's just, it's a lot of really cool information. And the way that it was presented on MLB.com, it was pretty seamless in a broadcast, because they would show, like, one example is they have, I think it was Anthony Recker throwing out Billy Hamilton trying to steal. So they show the play. Then they show a replay of it with a freeze frame showing, okay, here's how quickly the pitcher was went to home. Here's the speed of the ball. Here's the catcher's pop time. Here is how fast he threw it. Here is the how quickly the ball, or the length of that it beat Hamilton to the bag. Hamilton's first step. You know, all this stuff that it measured on that play. And like we talked last week a little bit, the more they have these kinds of things, the more information they'll have to make decisions as a front office or as fans calculating the data and looking at it. So it's pretty interesting stuff. But I think one of the concerns people had with it was that, okay, well, I don't want to see this stuff popping up. But the way they did it, you know, it was still presented the same way. You know, if you have the same play today, they'll show a replay, and they might show it from another angle. This is the same thing. They showed it the same way. It just had a freeze frame with a different overlay, and that was it. And it didn't, you know, they didn't have to pause the game for any longer. You know, it seemed just with the same flow of any broadcast or production that you otherwise would have had. And I think that's pretty cool. And we'll definitely link to that, because I think you should check it out. It's totally game changing, because, I mean, you know, if you know all of that information, you can adjust how you set your defense and, you know, everything else, you know, from a catcher standpoint, base running standpoint, pitcher times. I mean, there's so much information out there, and I think teams are going to utilize it a lot. But I think from an analytical point of view, it's really cool to get to see it.
The possibilities are quite literally endless. I mean, you hear talk about, and not as much other sports as you do baseball, or more so in other sports than you do in baseball a little bit, I think, the talk of game speed, like specifically football, for instance. Someone's 40 time, say they go to the NFL Combine and their 40 time is a 4.5 or something, and you say, well, you know, on tape, their game speed is much faster. You know, well, you have you know, someone like Aoki, who is a fast runner, but, you know, he's not all that great a base stealer, to be honest. And whether it's, you know, the jump that he gets, or whether it's, you know, he telegraphs that he's going to steal somehow, or, you know, whatever the case may be, there's something that limits him and limits a lot of players. And when you can put it into perspective of all these different numbers, then you can, not only can you make better decisions of, you know what, we know that Aoki can get first to second in X seconds, and pop time for Yadier Molina is, you know, X seconds. So we're not going to say, just don't run, you know. And like you said, that kind of ties into what we talked about last week. the amount of data that they're going to have soon after a season, multiple seasons, then you're really going to have a much more reliable, larger sample size. So you can say, well, because right now, you know, it's more or less, well, you know, the other day, Molina's pop time was this, and the other day, you know, and a couple times this season, Aoki was this fast going from first to second. Well, after you have, you know, multiple tens and hundreds of those instances, then you can say, all right, over the course of a, you know, a predictive sample size, Aoki was this fast, or Molina was, his pop time was this. And so that makes it quite a bit more, quite a bit more useful to have that data. And it's really, I mean, the what they've shown, like you said, is just really quite cool. Excuse me. And I mean, there is just a ton that they can do with this. I'm really excited to see where teams take this and how it can change the game, because it's something where it's funny, because you hear something like this, and I think a lot of people, especially those who maybe aren't necessarily as into the sabermetrics and the advanced stats like we are, might think, oh man, these machines and computers are just taking over baseball. And they're providing a lot more data, but I think it kind of, it almost, the human element has to grow with it, and it becomes even bigger in terms of decision making and strategic process, because with so much data, gives you so much more analysis and so many other ways to take advantage of that data. You know, like the whole Moneyball approach and everything that we've talked about before on this show, and that isn't, it's not something that was really that new, so much as it was just new data that somebody finally took advantage of, you know, and this is the kind of same deal. You know, you baseball players and baseball, quote unquote, baseball people have been saying forever, you know, oh, well, this player is fast and this player is a, you know, can throw it on the second base really fast on an attempted steal. This player can do this really well, or gets a great jump on the ball in the outfield. You know, well, now this is a way to truly measure that. And so instead of it just being a gut eyes thing, you know, you can see it with your eyes and say, man, Lorenzo Cain just gets a great jump on the ball. Alex Gordon gets a great jump on the ball. Now you can measure that so that you can take advantage of it. And you can say, well, you know, X percentage of the time, this particular batter, you know, this is a spray chart, so we can move Gordon over here and we can maybe cheat him an extra couple steps than we normally would, because we know now that on a reliable basis, he can get from point A to point B if that ball is hit over there and doesn't necessarily need to be those extra couple steps closer. And, you know, it seems kind of minuscule, but over the course of a season, those couple steps, those different plays, I mean, that makes a huge, that's why you're seeing all these big defensive shifts now, because people have realized, oh, wow, this makes a much bigger deal over the course of a season than you would normally think.
Yeah, and a lot of this is, it's kind of applying a technology with cameras and more accurate measurements over, you know, the big picture of each play. You know, each play is kind of its own thing, broken into a lot of things. But, I mean, a lot of this stuff has been measured already. I mean, first base coaches have a stopwatch. I mean, they'll keep an idea of how quickly a pitcher is moving home, you know, what kind of jump their guy can get, how quickly their pickoff throw is. You know, they'll measure pop times for catchers from, you know, when they catch the ball, stand up, make the throw. They'll, you know, they measure runners and going from home to first. They'll measure going, you know, home to second. They'll do all that stuff already. It's just, this is kind of applying it in a big data set that everybody's going to have. And even with like shifts, I mean, that's, you know, they were doing that. You know, Lou Boudreaux did that in the, you know, in the 40s against Ted Williams. I mean, that's not terribly new. It's just applying that information. And so, you know, yeah, it's really kind of taking it into a mathematical, analytical kind of way, but it's not doing it too much differently. It's just kind of a different medium of using similar information that other people might observe, making it more accurate, and then applying it better and giving teams a better edge. So I don't see any downside to it. I don't think anybody's expecting this to replace the games, because, you know, the whole point, you know, people working on this are baseball fans, people who will look at this from, you know, the civilian life, and guys who don't work in baseball are going to be looking at it because they're baseball fans. I mean, so often it boils down to people talking about, well, you just want to watch it on the spreadsheet, or, you know, computers don't play the game. No, they don't. I mean, I like watching Escobar do that, the Jeter throw, better than Jeter. I like seeing that. I like watching Alex Gordon dive down the line and preserve a perfect game. And I like seeing Lorenzo Cain, you know, track a ball to the wall and look, you know, effortless, whereas any other outfielder might have a problem. So, you know, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to appreciate the stats too, and it doesn't mean that, you know, I'm going to favor one or the other. It's that I'm going to look at both of those and appreciate the game that I see, and then also appreciate the results and look at the information and, you know, even the advanced stuff, and try to make a bigger picture of the game that I watch.
Yeah, and because, you know, there's, to that end, I mean, there's, you might look at the stat line and you can say, okay, Gordon went 1-for-4, but what you won't see that I also enjoy is, you know, kind of an offshoot of what you're talking about. You know, you see like one of those three at bats that Gordon didn't get a hit. Maybe he started off the count 0-2, and then he fouls off 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pitches and works it back up to 3-2, and then maybe gets a, you know, gets a line drive shot that just happens to be caught or something like that. You mm-hmm. know, you say, you know, that was an out, but that was a really great at bat, and that makes you, you know, when you see hard hit balls, even if they're outs, or you see someone tracking the ball well or having good at bats, then it's like, okay, you know, Gordon's maybe struggled, but looks like he might be coming out of this a little bit. And you can't see that from a stat line, and I think we all know that. And, you know, and it's interesting because this is something I heard on the radio this morning listening to Bob Fesco. Was he was talking about, you know, just why, just how all the people that are, you know, people like Mike and I, who like these advanced stats and sabermetrics and all this stuff, and we, you know, decry all the bad decisions that the Royals make, you know, just, he more or less told us to shut up because we're ruining the game, which I think is asinine. But, you know, it's a matter of perspective, just like most things. And this idea that appreciating stats and what they tell you about the decisions we make, or I'm sorry, the decisions that like the Royals make and baseball people make, is much different than, you know, this perception of the blogger, podcaster in the mother's basement, uber nerd who doesn't do anything but look at a spreadsheet, you know, because that's not the idea. And not to say that those people aren't out there, because I'm sure that they are, but, you know, I think the majority of us fall somewhere in that middle where we look at stats, we appreciate them, know what they mean, but then also know that there's a big component that's not on the stat sheet that we can also appreciate too. And I constantly, you know, that's the area. I mean, I'm an accountant by trade. The stat stuff is easy for me to understand. It's easy for me to understand how to apply it, why it's necessary, what makes sense. The harder stuff for me, and that I constantly look for more information on and try and learn about, are these scouting things. When can I tell that a player is struggling or why, and different things like that. You know, and you see there are different moments where we've talked about it. I think last week we talked about it, how Eric Hosmer can sometimes go in these kind of ins and outs of that low and away pitch, especially from left-handed pitchers, that he really struggles with. You know, he doesn't see it as well from different times. It's hard for him to lay off. You know, Gordon has the same problem. And, you know, being able to identify when they're struggling with those, or when Billy Butler doesn't feel comfortable at the plate, and how you identify that and what's going on. And I mean, those things are interesting to me as well. And those are things that aren't as easily identifiable, but are also equally as important. And, you know, this idea that it's either one or the other is just dumb, because mm-hmm. nothing should ever be that black and white. Nothing ever is. So, you know, we've kind of rambled on here, but on this show,
we do.
But, I mean, it's definitely something where, you know, having both is the optimal way. And I don't know why people don't seem to understand that. And people just assume, because you bring up one point or the other, that it's one, that you're on one side or the other. There's no sides here. It's all baseball. It's all knowledge. And, you know, the only time that any sort of arguments or you know, Twitter conversations tend to ratchet up a notch is when there's ignorance from one side or the other. And it comes from both sides. You know, there's a lot of it. And that's where you start to run into problems. But if if you're open-minded to either side, then, you know, it should all make sense. It's all baseball. It's all knowledge. It's all trying to get a better understanding of the game that you love. So we've kind of moved off a little bit to the philosophical component, but the ultimate point being it's really, you know, it's something that adds to the game in terms of what we talked about, this particular player tracker stuff. And it's not something that needs to be looked on as kind of the end of, you know, for lack of a better term, the end of the scout in baseball.
Yeah. And I think it's every year this happens, and kind of the inspiration for all of this anyway was Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, who, you know, legendary sports writer, came out with a thing basically saying, do baseball fans care about all the statistics? And you know, the same old, you know, chestnuts popped up. You know, he brought up Miguel Cabrera and the Triple Crown, and, you know, was all blustery about, you know, people who thought Mike Trout should have been MVP, which to him, it just seems preposterous. But really, I mean, you look at everything altogether, and I think that's what you have to do. You have to look at everything. And so his kind of ideas were that, you know, he said that people who preferred Trout were just up and down saying that Cabrera was not worthy of winning the MVP, which that was never a thing. I mean, it's pretty obvious to say that Cabrera would be deserving of MVP. It's just, is he more deserving than Trout? And when you look at things from the perspective of wins against replacement or wins above replacement, you know, the hitting wasn't too far off between the two in either year. The difference came in Trout being a much, much better base runner and an elite defender, and that really applying to give him the edge, because, you know, if he's performing in three facets of the game and all Cabrera is doing is hitting, you know, there you go. That's kind of what it is. And, you know, Ryan really kind of, he did the typical thing, the old school kind of thing, you know, nobody cares about these things. Why do you hate the pitcher win? Blah, blah, you know, fine. He's welcome to that, approach. I think it's silly. I think it's unnecessary, but whatever. But Dave Cameron of Fangraphs, and anybody who looks at baseball stats has been on Fangraphs, I'm sure, had a really good point and a really good explanation. And they don't usually talk about writers on there. They usually just want to stick to the baseball. But in this case, he brought it up because there were just a lot of, I guess, fallacies going on and a lot of different things. So he wanted to bring up the point that we look at the information because we want to be sure that our eyes aren't lying to us. It's really, really easy to be up there and say, well, I saw Billy Butler a couple games strike out in a clutch situation, so I don't think he's clutch. But you can look at the information and be like, well, this is what he hits with runners on. This is what he hits with runners on late. You know, it's pretty clear that he's been pretty good in the clutch over the course of his career. So, you know, that's a way to just disprove that kind of notion just by looking at it and saying, okay, well, what I thought, my preconceived notion is different based on the results.
And that's a fantastic point that he made, because it goes back to what you were talking about earlier with Justin Maxwell. You know, there's just this inordinate amount of love for Justin Maxwell in this city, probably mostly based on that grand slam. And fact of the matter is, I totally see how it happens, and I fall into that trap sometimes myself, because, you know, there's 162 games in a baseball season. You know, I have a full-time job, I have a fiance, I'm planning a wedding, I have dogs, I have a cat. You know, there's lots of other stuff that, you know, I and everybody has going on. You know, we're doing this podcast right now in the middle of a Royals game. So it's tough to watch every single game. And when you can't, and you can only watch, you know, three-fourths of the games or half the games or, you know, even less, then And you say, okay, well, the last five games I've watched, you know, Billy Butler's been 1-for-4, 0-for-4, whatever, all those games. So, you know, well, you can't just base it on that, because then it comes back to last week, what we were talking about with sample size, because then you're basing your own perception on just the sample size that you've seen. And so that's where stats become useful, because then you look and say, well, you know, it hasn't been quite that bad. You know, he still has, you know, his on-base percentage is still good, and he's still getting, you know, knocking runners in, whatever the case may be. You know, so I do think that's a very good point, that it, you know, it just the one side or the other kind of black or white argument bothers me. And I think that kind of succinctly points it out much better than I can, that we use these things to validate what we see with our eyes, is that we're not being deceived by our own preconceptions.
Yeah. And another point that Cameron made that I never really thought of was that if somebody starts to use a number, a measurement, whatever, more often, it'll be accepted in a lot of cases, because, you know, it becomes commonplace. It's expected, you know, even if it's complicated. And the example that he gave, well, I'll just ask you the question. What's the formula for quarterback rating?
I have absolutely no clue. I know it's something just ridiculous.
Yeah. But that doesn't stop NFL broadcasts from putting it on all the time. Doesn't stop writers from bringing it up. Doesn't stop teams and coaches from using it. So how is that different from wins above replacement? It's the same kind of, you know, single component number that's trying to calculate what a player is valued at. You know, that's what you're kind of trying to look at. You can glance at it and say, okay, he's got a QB rating of 100. That's probably a good quarterback. Same thing. You can look at a guy who's a 6 WAR player and say, that's probably a good player. And that's all you're trying to do with these numbers. I couldn't give you the full formula for WAR, but I just, understanding kind of what it means is enough. I can glance at it and be like, okay, there you go. And you don't have to sit down and calculate it all the time. You don't have to do that. You just have to kind of understand what it means. In a lot of cases, it's not that, it's not that difficult of a thing to do. I mean, some things are difficult. I mean, I still don't quite understand, like, UZR, ultimate zone rating. It seems like some players it's really, really kind to, and some it's not. And, you know, I never really can understand how it really fits there, but that's fine. But, you know, if you start using things more regularly, they will become commonplace and people will expect to see them and they'll be more comfortable with them. I mean, you saw the Houston Astros early in the year, and I think mostly in spring training, they would try to broadcast using things like weighted on base average and different calculations to really show, okay, here's some advanced stats, and, you know, you talk about it. Today, the Royals, the pregame show, talked about ERA minus, which is, you know, just relative value of the ERA. And the more people will talk about those, the more people will be comfortable with them. You know, I had one of my Twitter followers, we were talking about inherited runners, and he sent me a DM. He wasn't completely sure what we were talking about, and so I just explained, it's like, here's what it is. I mean, this is what the league average generally is, and here's where this pitcher is, and, you know, that's kind of what it means. And, you know, that's all it was. It's, you know, it seems like it's really tough, inaccessible information, but in a lot of cases it's pretty simple once you kind of take the time to ask the question what they're trying to measure with that. And that's all, you know, I think from a stat side is all you're really looking for, is just having, you know, a little bit more understanding of, you know, what's being measured, what's being discussed, and how it applies to whatever situation and how it matches what you see on the field. I mean, that's my approach, is like, I might see something and think, oh, is he doing this? You know, is he having this kind of problem? And then you can look at the numbers and be like, yeah, it seems like he is. The flip side is like, well, you can look on the stats and be like, well, it seems like he's having this problem. And then you can watch a little more closely on like a righty versus righty matchup and say, okay, it seems like he's not able to hit righties very well. And now you go watch him in a bat and some guys diving across the plate and really off balance, and you can kind of see why his stats look bad. And that's, you know, it's two sides of a coin, and you can't use half of a coin. So you've got to use both sides. And it's the same way that I try to approach watching baseball. And I don't see why that can't be the case for more people.
Yeah, and I think one of the best things that things like WAR and OPS plus and ERA minus and those things do is similar to the quarterback rating example you brought up. It just provides a basis for comparison because, you know, you can have somebody like Mark Trumbo who's just, you know, jacking home run after home run, but when he's getting on, his on base percentage is .285, you know, and his defense isn't that great, then you've got a different scenario where all of a sudden he doesn't really provide as much value as it seems just because home runs are such a big deal, you know? And so that's kind of my favorite part about looking at this stuff is it kind of evens the playing field in terms of, you know, how we truly evaluate a player, because you can quantify things that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they were there and everybody knew they were part of the game, but they just weren't quantified. And I think that's kind of the overarching point is that, you know, there's new information every day. And instead of being shunned, it should be welcomed so that, you know, we can glean as much knowledge as we possibly can. You always want to make the best decisions. You want to have the most knowledge possible. You know, you wouldn't go and, I mean, if you, so I'm an accountant. Let's say, you know, I decide, hey, I'm going to go and travel in Europe for 10 years and not work as an accountant. Okay, well, when I come back, you know, I'm not just going to assume, hey, I knew everything that I needed to know about accounting 10 years ago, so I don't need to know anything more, right? I don't need to study up on anything or whatever. And just go. You know, I wouldn't do that. You wouldn't do that in any profession. So the idea that, you know, you grew up 20 years ago when you were playing baseball and this is how you did things. And so, you know, that's the only way to do it. And they decide using all these weird advanced stats that you don't know just seems stupid. Like that, you know, I don't know where that comes from. And I don't know why baseball's not the only sport. There's lots of, you know, there's different aspects of lots of sports that fail to embrace these kind of changing of the tides with certain things like that. And I just don't understand why. You know, maybe it's just because there's such a large groupthink aspect to it that it's really hard to change that. And I think that's a big piece of it. But it's just always been so odd to me that you would just hold people seem to cling to these beliefs. One side or the other, it goes both ways. I'm not casting dispersions on either side because I definitely know it goes both ways, but it's so odd to me that people on either side would just hold so tightly to something and not want to just advance as far as they possibly can in terms of knowledge.
Or at least pick up a few things. I mean, I'm not going to be sitting there building spreadsheets and making regression models and running, you know, simulate. I'm not going to do that. But if somebody else does it, I'm going to look at it and be like, okay, I can see what, you know, this projection came out. And now I kind of see an idea of something and I can make my own judgments off of that and see how it matches, you know, what I see on the field, any other research I might do, things like that. And from a baseball organization standpoint, I don't see why you wouldn't want more information if it's good information. I mean, if you can pick out what the good information is and put it together, I mean, why wouldn't you use it and come up with the, you know, the best approach to building your team and putting them out on the field? Why would you not do that? I mean, they've always kind of done it. And it's kind of funny because Bob Ryan, going back to his column, he was talking about, you know, why do you have to do all this stuff with all this information? Why can't you just be good baseball men who just kind of knew tendencies? Well, he also brought up, you know, Boudreau, who did the Williams shift, and Earl Weaver, who would always have like index cards with matchup by matchup for different hitters. And so those are like forerunners to a lot of this stuff, because that's taking, you know, advanced information and apply, you know, breaking it down and applying it to situations on the field that'll give you an edge. And I don't see why a team wouldn't want an edge. I don't see why a person wouldn't want their team to do what they can to make an edge.
Yeah, I mean, that's tantamount to saying, you know, well, you don't need to know that you can deduct your student loan interest from your taxes or your mortgage interest from your taxes. You just need to know that you have to pay taxes. You know, I mean, you know, why can't you just know that you have to pay taxes and, you know, you get deductions and that, you know, there are some deductions you get and some credits you get or something, like, you know what I mean? That's not exactly the best, you know, apples to apples example, but
just sign the paper.
That's more or less.
What do you got to use a calculator?
You know, like, why do you have to have as much information as possible? Why can't you just know? It's like, well, even if I just know, you know, the idea of having something to back that up that I can look to that can aid in my decision-making process is never a bad thing. Data is never a bad thing. The idea that you would try and say so is just odd to me, but it appears we've rambled far, far longer than, you know what?
This is remember when we said this could be a short show?
Yeah, we always say that.
That always happens.
It always does. It always ends up being like an hour and a half or 2 hours. And I'm not even going to apologize this time, because that is what we do on this show. And my guess is, if you're listening out there, that's why you listen. So hopefully you had an extra long drive somewhere and you got to listen to us for an extra long amount of time, because what a treat for you. But with that, I think we're going to end it, and we'll be back next week. Hopefully, it's a holiday weekend, but I think we can probably still be back to the normal schedule. Hopefully, next week we'll have to see. But don't forget this coming Sunday. So this on May 25th is the Kelly's Block Party. We've been pumping it for a while. It's going to be a lot of fun. Lost Wax goes on at 9:30. Everything starts at 8:00. Nobody has to work on Monday. It's Memorial Day. Go out, have yourself some beers, have yourself some good time, and support our local sponsor, Kelly's Westport Inn, who has been unbelievably good to us and deserves everything from everybody in terms of support. So go on out there, have yourself a good time. Hope you enjoyed the show today. As always, I am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me, of course, the infinitely incomparable Michael Engel. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for stopping in. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. This has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault, presented by Kelly's Westport Inn. And as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.
Yay.